Charles D. is being interviewed by Renee Garalick for Concord's Oral History Program, sponsored by the Concord Historical Commission. The interview is taking place at his home at 37 Bedford Street on May 12, 1982. Mr. D. is 58 years old. You are the third generation of D.'s in the funeral business, and they in turn had taken it over and worked with William T. Farah. Could you explain a bit about the funeral business and the preceding generations?
Yes, I will, Renee. But first I have to go back to it's Willard T. Farah.
Okay.
The D. family came from Ireland in the 1860s. They came from a farming community in Ireland, in the county of Waterford, near the small town called Grange, halfway between Yawhall and Dungarvan. When they arrived in America, it was my great-grandfather, Joseph D., who arrived and lived in Charlestown, and walked from Charlestown out to Lincoln, which in those days wasn't much of a task for these people to walk that distance. And he got a job at the Brooks Farm in Lincoln, where he lived in one of their houses. And that's where my grandfather, Joseph D. Jr., was born. And I might mention that my grandmother, Elizabeth Kanar, was also a native of Lincoln. The name Kanar is the Irish pronunciation of Kenna.
Mm-hmm.
And they moved to the Fay Farm on Bedford Street in the late 1860s. And I found in one of Henry Thoreau's notations about that time that he mentioned an Irish family had bought the Fay Farm.
And it was yours.
And it was my great-grandfather's, yes. Now, in order for them to come from Lincoln to Concord, naturally they had to come in a wagon. And my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother took their five children in one wagon load, with children and possessions, came down Lexington Road, through the gate of Bronson Offutt's home, up over the hill to their farm on Bedford Street. Bedford Street at that time wasn't a main thoroughfare as it is today. If you had to go to Bedford from Concord Center, you had to go down Lexington Road and then Old Bedford Road. And the main reason was that beyond Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, as we know it today, there was quite a bog there and a low area in the road. And at certain times of the year, you couldn't get through it with your wagon. So that's why they came up over the hill through Louise Mayalcott's yard. I always think that one reason that my great-grandparents came to this area was that they were interested in farming because of the farming community they came from in Ireland. My great-grandfather, along with his farming duties, was the grave digger at Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. And it was through this position that Willard T. Farah, the local undertaker, recognized the aptitudes of my grandfather and asked him to come to work for him one day and asked him if he wanted to learn the funeral business. And Grandpa accepted this challenge, and immediately went to work for Willard Farah. Willard Farah passed on in 1910, and my grandfather assumed the business at that time, buying his property and what have you.
Mr. Farah was a furniture maker?
Mr. Farah, besides being the local undertaker, was a cabinet maker. It's a situation that prevailed throughout the whole New England area. The undertaker was usually a cabinet maker because he made the coffins to order. There wasn't any stockpiling in those days. And it was sort of a natural state of affairs that the cabinet maker would make the coffin. And that's how the funeral business grew in New England. It grew from the demand of the people asking the undertaker to do more and more. The hearse in each community was owned by the town. And an interesting thing about it is the similarity of today's fire trucks. You know, the town owns the fire trucks and the citizens have it for their disposal. And the hearse in those days was owned by the town. And it was for the disposal or the use of any of its inhabitants. And as the funeral business grew, families, as I mentioned before, asked the funeral director to do more and more. They would not only ask him to make the coffin, they would ask him to transport the coffin to the church, and then to the cemetery. And this is how a lot of the funeral businesses that are in business today in New England started. And as I remember, going back through some of our early records, our records start in 1868. And in fact, the town records are the D funeral home records, mm-hmm. because in 1937, when the WPA became in existence, which was President Roosevelt's way of helping the economy, each town employed people to copy records of our nature so that the town would have a copy or a card file of burials in the town cemeteries. And those card files still exist.
The town hearse you have still in on your residence here.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, we're proud of that. Yes, Willard Farah and Grandpa had two wagon hearses. This old one was quite small, and it was quite conservative. It's the conservative type of hearse that the town of Concord would have had in those days. But in later years, Grandpa had a more ornate hearse, wagon hearse, and with six big plumes on the top. And an interesting thing about this, it didn't have any glass sides, but it did have heavy black drapes. And I asked my father one day, "Dad, where did that hearse go?" "Well," he said, "son, I think once when your grandfather bought a new wagon, auto hearse, he thought we had to get rid of that hearse. It was taking up too much space, and he sold it to an undertaker in Maine. And I often wonder which undertaker it was that he sold it to." An interesting thing about the town hearse is that in back of the First Parish Church, and you can see this in some of the old photographs of the First Parish Church, there are quite a row of hoss stables. And you know, those were there because the on a cold winter's day when people came to church, they spent most of the day on Sunday in church. And on in that row of horse stables, in back of the First Parish Church, was one stable with doors on it. And that was the hearse house. And those doors were there to protect the hearse, because it was a cherished possession owned by the town, you know. But later the hearse and the hearse house was moved up by the first gate that we call Sleepy Hollow today, but in those days it was called the New Hill Burying Ground. And then later in this conversation I'll go through the different histories of the different cemeteries. But to continue with the old hearse and the hearse house, it was moved from the beside the entrance to the cemetery to the further easterly corner. And reading about it in one of the old town reports, someone had put in an article in the town report to ask the town to paint the hearse house and also to paint the hearse, which was also in bad need of repair. And as a boy, and as the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery expanded, that hearse house ended up over in back of Joe Culkin's house on Bedford Street. And the reason for that was the fellow that lived in that house at that time was a caretaker of the cemetery. And I remember playing in that old hearse house as a boy, but in later years it's fallen down.
There was a custom for a while of tolling the bell when someone died.
Yes, and that's an interesting thing, because Concord was a small community in those days. And if someone was ill, most of the town knew about it. And as they were working in the fields and going about their everyday lives, if the bells tolled at an odd time, and it would be a signal that a person had passed on. And if a male died, they tolled the bell once. If a female died, they tolled it twice, and three times for a child.
Mm-hmm. And this was done at the First Parish Church.
This is the First Parish Church, because, you know, originally the First Parish Church's budget was the town's budget. Mm. So it was all connected.
And the undertaker had a very formal attire to wear.
Yes. We still have some of the old beaver hats that Willard Farrer and my grandfather wore. And actually, I have his coffin-making bench and some of his tools. And they're really something. They're all brass-edged and what have you. And this year, the National Funeral Directors Association met in Boston at the Prudential Building. And I loaned them a lot of the old antiques from Concord's first undertaker, and they were so proud to display them. And it created quite an exhibit.
I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
Well, would you like to explain Concord's cemeteries?
Yes, Renee. I'm going to list the cemeteries and then go back to them. There's the Main Street Cemetery, which is between the Middlesex Savings Bank and the library. And there's the Hill Burying Ground that is now beside the Catholic Church. But that was the church burying ground for the First Parish Church originally, because the original First Parish Church stood across the street on Lexington Road where that stone house is today.
I see.
Then, of course, after the Hill Burying Ground became quite full, over here on Bedford Street, they started what was called the New Hill Burying Ground. And right beside that, there's a Schoolhouse District Number 2 that is used for the Sleepy Hollow workers as a tool house. My grandfather went to the 5th grade in that schoolhouse, and that was a one-room schoolhouse. And I remember as a boy, it had a pot-bellied stove, and it had a long metal pipe going from the pot-bellied stove up to the chimney, and the stove sat right in the middle of the room. Well, after the town stopped using that as a schoolhouse, my grandfather used it for funerals. And we called it the chapel. I say we called it the chapel. Of course, I wasn't in the funeral business then, but maybe I had a hankering to get in. And there was an organ in there, and there weren't too many funerals from there, but my grandfather put up the electricity into that building, and I noticed it's still up there and still working. And one of those rooms was used as the preparation room. It was one large room and two smaller rooms. And one of the rooms was used for the preparation room, and that's where the bodies were prepared for burial. And at that time, I remember, and I still, when I see one of the boys, younger boys in those days, used to get paid $1.50 by Grandpa to stay there all night so that there'd be someone there
with the body.
Somebody's loved one.
That's nice.
My grandfather had 8 sons and 1 daughter, and they've all passed on except my aunt, Mrs. Margaret Benn. But all of my uncles also got into the situation of staying there overnight, so that they, and their boyfriends, and this was quite a thing. And they also got into the funeral business by well, actually, to go back a little further, Grandpa was also in charge of digging all the graves in Sleepy Hollow. And some of the boys from Bedford Street used to dig the graves. I think they used to get $2 a grave, and that was a big $2.
I'm sure. Sleepy Hollow began in around 1858?
Yes. The first burial in Sleepy Hollow was in 1823, and her name is Mrs. Anna Robbins, and it's interesting to note that fact is noted on her gravestone. Now see, the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery is the further end of what we call Sleepy Hollow today, and that is a glacial formation called an esker. And an esker was made as the glacier receded north. It left these pools of water, sandy pools of water. And usually the pools ran off on one end, leaving a natural amphitheater. And Sleepy Hollow was called Sleepy Hollow long before it was a cemetery. And it was owned by the Reuben Brown family. And it said that area was one of the areas that Emerson liked to go and meditate. And I do want to clarify the Sleepy Hollow in Concord, because a lot of people confuse it with Washington Irving's the Tale of the Headless Horseman, which is in Tarrytown, New York. And that's also Sleepy Hollow Cemetery.
And one has nothing to do with another.
That's right, Renee.
Then it became a town cemetery in that 1858 period.
Right.
I see.
And the area between Sleepy Hollow that we were just discussing, in the old hill burying ground, or the new hill burying ground, I should say, and the old schoolhouse that we've been transformed, there was what you call the agricultural field. Now, the agricultural field had a cinder racetrack and a clubhouse, and there was all sorts of fairs went on there in those the old days. And even today, now that we have it all mapped out as cemetery property with roads and what have you, every so often when we're digging a grave, we run across the cinder racetrack.
Oh, my.
Well, to get back to the different cemeteries, the main we talked about the Main Street Cemetery and the Hill Burying and Sleepy Hollow and what have you. There are three other cemeteries in town with one or two graves in them. And these graves were smallpox burials. You know, in the old days, they didn't know about much about medicine as they do today. And to curb any smallpox epidemic, the families would bury the victim as soon as possible after death. And they would burn most of their bedding and what have you as a precaution, because, you know, in the old days, they dreaded an epidemic, because they just didn't have the way to fight. There's another cemetery in West Concord that hasn't attached too much importance because people don't really know about it, and that is the prison cemetery.
Mm.
And in fact, we just had a prison burial up there this year, and the last one that we had there was 20 years ago. So it's not used very often. And the amazing part of that cemetery is, instead of gravestones, there's numbers on the stone.
I
see. So each prisoner had a number. And my father and Harold Orendorff charted all the veterans' graves in Concord and did an excellent job. And so that today, when the veterans' organizations put out the flags on the veterans' graves on Memorial Day, it's pretty well charted, thanks to James D. And Harold Orendorff. But what I was getting at was, there's four Civil War veterans buried in that prison cemetery, which is interesting.
Yes,
and some of the prisoners buried in that Civil War in that prison cemetery were also prisoners from Charlestown Prison, which doesn't exist today.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they got there was that they were put on the train in Boston and sent out to Concord and transferred at the junction onto that spur, and their coffins were unloaded at the prison cemetery right off Route 2, because the cemetery or the railroad track was right by the cemetery.
I see. Now, the smallpox deaths, were they concentrated in one particular location?
No, the smallpox cemetery, one on Fayhaven Road, at the junction of Route 2. Okay. There's a second smallpox cemetery in back of the Barrett's home, Colonel Barrett's home, on Barrett's Mill Road, which is presently the McGrath House. And the third cemetery of that nature is supposedly in the backyard of the Hosmer House on Main Street. And the Hosmer House is that lovely center chimney colonial as you, on your right as you go under the underpass on the railroad. And I have the feeling that they were burying this person in their backyard, but today there's three houses between the cemetery and the house. As you know, the town was settled in 1635, but there's no graves in evidence until 1677 and 1697. That's on the hill burying in the Main Street burying ground. And the history states that the Main Street burying ground was a gift to the town by two maiden ladies. And it's somewhat confusing because the gift wasn't given until 1775. That's 78 years after the burial. That Main Street Cemetery was first known as the Stratton Burying Ground. And the only reason we can figure that out is that there are Strattons buried there. Mr. and Mrs. Stratton, and a Dorothy Stratton. And it's believed that the reason that that was the Stratton Cemetery was that one of their children was first buried there, and they had drowned in the Concord River. And that cemetery isn't far from the river. And it's believed that Main Street, instead of coming right straight down from the library, at one time came around the further side of the Main Street Cemetery and back onto Main Street by the Savings Bank, because all the gravestones face that way. And in all the cemeteries in the area, the gravestones face the main road. And it's interesting to note that the center of community life in the early days in Concord, when those cemeteries were at prominence, Jethro's oak tree stood halfway between the two. And you know, there was a running body of water that ran between the two cemeteries. That was the Mill Brook, and of course the Mill Dam was made from Mill Brook. It was an old myth that it was unlucky to carry a coffin with a body in it over a running body of water, which at one time accounted for the two different cemeteries, which would be in the same era. But I think this is a fallacy, because the people from the Nine Acre Corner area of Concord are buried on the Main Street burying ground, and they would have had to be carried across the Sudbury River, which sort of puts an end to that.
And the graves of the early settlers, many of them were unmarked.
Yes, Renee. And it's said that that some of them were buried in the roadways to hide their deaths, so that the graves wouldn't be found by the Indians, so that they wouldn't know that they were diminishing in number. But myself, I don't think this is true, because my research at the Peabody Museum in Salem has come up with a very interesting an idea. You know, in those days, they didn't have gravestones. They made mostly do with things out of wood. And I think that the early settlers of Concord, their gravestones were made of wood. And of course, they decayed and disappeared. And maybe a couple of generations of people would have replaced those wooden gravestones, but after a while, that idea of making a gravestone for your great-grandfather might have diminished a little. And
there's logic in that.
So many country cemeteries are on hills. Well, being in the funeral business as I am, I came to the conclusion that it's an awful hard thing to dig a grave in the wintertime through snow and ice and 3 feet of frost. And the first places in the springtime that are cleared of snow and frost are the hillsides.
Mm.
And when I drive up through the countryside in Maine, Hampshire, and Vermont and see those cemeteries on the hills, I say to myself, they were smart to think of that. In the New Hill Burying Ground, the first burial was Mrs. Anna Robbins in 1823. And this fact is noted on her stone. And she is buried right in the middle of that cemetery area, just as the Strattons are buried right in the middle of the Main Street area. And the first burial on the Hill Burying Ground that's noted is Joseph Merriam, of Merriam's Corner fame, and a gunsmith. And he's buried right in the center of that cemetery.
That's the old hill.
The old hill.
Mm-hmm.
And the first burial in Sleepy Hollow itself is a Mrs. Maria Holbrook, who died in 1859. And that fact is noted on her gravestone.
But today we've come to talk about Sleepy Hollow and the New Hill Burying Ground as one.
And as one.
Mm-hmm.
And it is run by the town, and the D family no longer have to dig the graves.
I see.
An interesting point about the land adjacent to the agricultural field that was purchased by the town in 1883, it was voted to keep that spot as an open space.
Hmm.
And it shows that the town was thinking of conservation and open spaces way back in 1883. Now the Catholic cemetery, which is down the street on Bedford Street, the first burial there was in 1876. The Catholic Church was purchased in 1863, and the cemetery was in existence in 1864. It said that that area was given to the Catholics for some of the war dead in the Civil War.
To you, Sleepy Hollow is American Westminster Abbey, you've said a number of times.
Yes, yes, and I think that's a wonderful phrase for Sleepy Hollow in the 1800s to be referred to as America's Westminster Abbey, because there's so many world-famous people buried there. Henry Thoreau and his mother and father and Sophie are buried there. As you know, Henry Thoreau was a naturalist. Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was America's first romantic writer, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was a poet and an essayist. And of course, Louise May Alcott, who wrote Little Women, Little Men, many other books, and her father, who was equally as famous, A. Bronson Alcott. And another author is Margaret Sidney, who wrote Five Little Peppers and other children's works. Ephraim Wales Bull, who was the creator of the Concord Grape, he crossed the various wild grapes on the Concord hillsides until he got a purple grape, And his grape today is mostly grown in the Finger Lakes of New York and in the California region. And an interesting thing about the seedlings of the Concord grape, it's my understanding that after World War I, when a lot of the vineyards of France were depleted and shot out, that they were replenished by seedlings of the Concord grape. Mm. And another famous woman of that era that's buried in Sleepy Hollow is Elizabeth Palm Peabody, founder of Kindergartens in America. And of course, our own Daniel Chester French, world-famous sculptor, whose first work was the Minuteman statue, and his last work was the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. And I remember when I was over in England during the Second World War, I was surprised when I ran across some statues over there in London by Daniel Chester French. It made me feel right at home.
He did the memorial to the Melvin brothers in the cemetery?
Yes, the Melvin Memorial in Sleepy Hollow was one of the outstanding memorials in the cemetery itself. And it's a statue of a woman draped in a flag with an olive branch in her hand and a dove on her shoulder. And the name of the sculpture is Mourning Victory, in the sense of one being mourning for someone. And it's in honor of three Melvin brothers who died in the Civil War. And the fourth brother came back to Concord and erected this monument in his brother's honor.
They lived on Lowell Road?
They lived, their family home was on Lowell Road. But Lowell Road today is high, but it ran through that valley originally, and their farmhouse was down that area. An interesting thing about the Melvin Memorial statue itself, the architect for that monument was Bacon, and the architect for the Lincoln Memorial building in Washington, D.C. was Bacon. Mm-hmm. And French, Daniel Chester French and Bacon worked together quite a bit. Yes, another interesting stone is the Weldon Stone. And it's a large family lot right across from Ephraim Hoyle's Bull's gravestone. And the corner posts of this lot are made exactly of the exact shape of the Bunker Hill Monument. And the reason for that is Mr. Weldon was the architect for the Bunker Hill Monument.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go up to the top of the hill where Thoreau and Louise May Alcott and Hawthorne are buried, you pass the grave of Sam Staples. And Sam was the fellow who put Thoreau in jail. And Thoreau was put in jail because he wouldn't pay his taxes. And Sam said to Henry, "I'll pay your taxes, Henry." But Henry said, "No." He objected to the government going into the Mexican War, and he thought his money was going to be used for that. And it's ironic that the two fellows are buried not far from each other.
Yes, it is. Well, you even have the first woman who drove an automobile, licensed to drive an automobile, buried there.
Yes. She's buried back this way further in the cemetery, more on the agricultural field area. And her name is Mrs. Bush. And she was the first woman in the United States to receive an automobile driver's license. And she got it from Washington.
the most, I guess, famous grave of the Old Hill Burying Ground is John Jack's grave. Didn't you say that?
Yes. John Jack's grave and Henry Thoreau's grave, we found, are the two most sought graves in the past. But it's the anniversary of Emerson's death this year, and we found a tremendous amount of people visiting his grave and his family plot.
Mm-hmm. Now, the John Jack grave, there was a duplicate rubbing made.
Yes. When I was on the cemetery committee, we gave permission for the Smithsonian Institute to come up and make a copy of John Jack's grave. They did this by putting layers and layers of some sort of rubbery substance on it, and then afterwards cutting it off on the edges and taking it back to the Smithsonian Institute and making an exact duplicate of the gravestone.
And this was done?
That was done in May of 1970.
Mm-hmm.
So any Concordians visiting the Smithsonian Institute will not only see Lindbergh's plane, but they will see a gravestone from Concord.
Did you want to read the John Jack inscription?
Oh, fine.
And explain who John Jack was?
Now, John Jack was a Negro slave. And a group of lawyers got together and financed putting a headstone up for John Jack and a footstone, which they did in those days. And why don't I just go through his epitaph? And it has a lot of meaning in both in those days and today. God wills us free. Men wills us slaves. I will as God will. God's will be done. Here lies the body of John Jack, a native of Africa, who died March 1773, about age 60 years. Though born in the land of slavery, he was born free. Though he lived in the land of liberty, he lived a slave. Till by his honest, though stolen labors, he acquired the source of slavery, which gave him his freedom. Though not very long before, death, the grand tyrant, gave him his final epitaph and set him on footing with kings. Though a slave to vice, he practiced these virtues, without which kings are but slaves. Another interesting grave back in Sleepy Hollow is the George Frisbie Hoar grave. George Frisbie Hoar was a senator from Massachusetts to Congress. And the Hoar family was an outstanding family in the state of Massachusetts. They go back to the days of the Indians, when they had a group of them living on their premises called the Praying Indians. And down through the years, they've been in all sorts of political positions that have given their time and their knowledge to the Commonwealth and to the country. And George Frisbie Hoar's last speech to Congress is inscribed on his gravestone.
I see.
And it goes like this. I have no faith in fatalism, in destiny, in blind force. I believe in God, the living God. I believe in the American people as a free and just people who will not bow the neck nor bend the knee to anyone, and do not want anyone to bow the neck nor bend the knee to them. I believe that a republic is greater than an empire, that today is better than yesterday, and that tomorrow will be better than today.
Would you describe Mrs. Hosmer's funeral the last time the town hearse was used at her request?
Right. Well, Mrs. Hosmer was one of Concord's outstanding citizens, and she was a historian and an archivist. And she died in March of 1970. But prior to that time, she asked me if I would take her to the graveyard in the old wagon house. And I promised her that I would. And when she passed on, her family called me and said, "Charlie, are you going to comply with her wishes?" And I said to them, if the hearse will run, I certainly will. So Gladys' funeral was at the Episcopal Church on Elm Street. And she died over a weekend. And during the weekend, I had my men practicing carrying the coffin as they did in the 1800s. They carried it on their shoulders. And, you know, we found out that the reason they carried the casket on their shoulders in the old days was that when they got to the hearse, it was right at an even point so that they could put the casket right into the hearse.
Hmm.
So we learned something from these different things. But Gladys was a real historian, and we wanted to do what we could to comply with her wishes. And we took the wheels off the old hearse and greased them up as we did in the old days, as they did in the old days. And we washed the hearse down, and I engaged Nick Roddy to use his horse. And we at first were going to bring Mrs. Hosmer's casket up to the church in the hearse, but in the regular auto hearse, but decided after we drove the wagon hearse around our yard and up and down Bedford Street a little bit, that it was in pretty good shape and was going to stay together. So we left the D funeral home, and we went up in procession to the church on Elm Street. And as we went through Concord Center with the wagon hearse, people stood on the side of the street amazed at what they were seeing, because we didn't try to publicize this in any way. It wouldn't be right. And after the service at the Episcopal Church, we came back through Concord Center on our way to Sleepy Hollow. And the streets were lined with people. You'd think it was the 19th of April. And as the hearse went through Concord Center, you could hear the clippity-clop of the horse's hoofs. It was the only thing you could hear. The people stood on the sidewalk with real reverence. And as we went by the First Parish Church and the Wright Tavern, the bells tolled Mrs. Hosmer's age.
Oh, my. That's beautiful.
Which was a tribute to a grand Concordian.
Thank you.